Well, thanks everyone for coming to the 2012 FPGB Summer School on the theme of protest. So I hope you've all picked up a copy of the programme, which has got a detail of the five talks. So we'll start off with the first talk of the weekend, which is Janet's sermon on the Arab Spring. After Janet spoke, we'll open the floor up to questions and discussion. We'll aim to finish, well, depending on how much discussion there is, around about 9 o'clock-ish, but it doesn't have to be dead on 9. And afterwards, the bar's open and through there. Okay, so I'd like to hand the floor over to Janet.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, Janet.
Welcome. Okay, I've put that up to start with. There's a couple more, and I'll explain as we go through what it's about, really, okay? So, I don't know what you think about this Arab Spring, but it's been a long-winded affair, and it's still cooking up good and proper in certain areas. So what I started with here was some of the things have changed. I've gone along by necessity. It's incredible. So you can pick me up on things later that you find are out of date. I'd be happy with that, okay? While certain elements of this topic are still ongoing and may be featured from time to time in our daily news bulletins, most of it's been confined to the bin of history as far as Western nations are concerned. It's over and done with, for better or worse, and we can move on and concern ourselves with more pressing current events. However, for those living daily with the consequences of earlier protests, it's a different story. And actually, in the months since my sounding me out about giving this talk, things have moved on considerably in different ways, various ways around the region. I'd like to briefly revisit some of the major earlier happenings in sequence to refresh memories of how this phenomenon unfolded before trying to put them into some kind of context. The maps, I hope, will help for reference purposes as we weave our way through various historical and contemporary alliances, client-master relationships, and just to be clear, whose neighbours the various nations are. The history of this whole region is about conquest and colonialism and different social structures according to religion and clan affiliations. Migration and remigration of peoples of North Africa and the Middle East over the centuries resulted in the myriad of ethnic mixes which account for the regional variations to be found today. Add to this that he was the cradle of the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity and Islam, and all the proselytizing, conquering, warmongering and peacemaking inter-tribe agreements that went on to bring us to the Ottoman Empire era and its eventual final breakup by Western imperialists post-World War I. There are a few of these handouts. Have a look up on the table if you want to actually see the details more on the maps. This last century witnessed the European powers being largely responsible for the current shape, the physical boundaries of all of this area. Conflicts are often related to where lines are being drawn on maps. Boundaries where none existed, limiting traditional tribal migrations or imprisoning populations on for them the wrong side of the border. And the decisions as to where the borders would be was out of the hands of the local populations and solely at the behest of Western conquerors, treaties forged between the Western allies who won that particular war. So we're talking about a region, a very large region, created in a manner to benefit the imperialist leaders of the world through client states, vassal states, whether for resource control, strategic influence or trade route, but in such a way to subjugate and control the whole area contrary to long-established traditional norms. We'll return to this from time to time, but meantime, let's look at the start of the protests and some of the reasons cited for the mass public demonstrations. This is a short timeline of the first bit of this thing. While there have been severe economic and unemployment problems all around the region, resulting from the economic downturn of 2008, as they had been around the wider world, the spark that caused a sudden widespread protest called the Arab Spring happened just 18 months ago, on December 18, 2010, when Mohamed Bouazizi of Tunisia set himself on fire following a humiliating episode at the hands of police. Barely a month later, after huge protests and dozens killed by the security forces, Ben Ali, the long-term ruler, was forced to flee. By January 25th, 2011, demonstrations began in Egypt against the Mubarak regime. After 3 days, troops and tanks were called onto the streets to quell the riots, but the people at that time welcomed the army as being their supporters and upholders of the people's rights. The very next day, Yemen's Abdul Saleh tried to preempt similar uprisings by starting talk with the opposition about reform. Meanwhile, some of his opponents were attacked while trying to organise a march in support of the Egyptian people. This sparked mass demonstrations in Sana'a a few days later against their government. Now, by February the 11th, Mubarak stepped down and a military council was formed to run the country's affairs. February the 14th brought the Day of Rage anti-government protest in Bahrain. Then, in just 3 weeks, starting on February the 15th, a human rights activist was arrested in Benghazi, Libya, starting protests. Then anti-government forces took control in Misrata, and the National Transitional Council in Benghazi declared itself the sole representative of Libya. And on March the 10th, France recognised the NTC, National Transition Council, as the legitimate representative of Libya. March the 15th brought martial law to Bahrain, followed by a heavy-handed crackdown on their camp at Pearl Roundabout. March the 16th, in Damascus, Syria, there was a small demonstration of 150 people holding photographs of imprisoned relatives, which were broken up by the security forces. March the 17th, the United Nations voted for a no-fly zone and RTP, responsibly to protect civilians in Libya, followed almost immediately by airstrikes targeting Gaddafi's insignificant and ageing Air Force planes. That was the sequence of just 3 months, the Arab Spring. So many things happened in quick succession all around the region. And here I haven't mentioned Morocco, Algeria, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan, Iran, non-Arab, but within the area, all experiencing protests to some degree or another, or having steps taken by the ruling elite to try and divert rising disquiet. Changes of ministers, lifting of security laws, release of some political prisoners, massive subsidies of basic foodstuffs, and on and on and on. Now, the suddenness of events in Tunisia seemed to take the world by surprise. After the 2008 recession hit world tourism, numbers had fallen dramatically, affecting business generally, and specifically those individuals who worked in the informal sector for low pay and poor conditions. Bourguiba, the previous leader of Tunisia, he led from sometime in the 60s, had been popular as a secularist and a liberator of women, and his government provided good social welfare, and he was respected for his honesty. When he died, he was just living in a very simple home, and he didn't have any money in the bank. Now, Ben Ali had been his head of security, of public security, and later he was prime minister, when in 1987 he staged a bloodless coup, pre-approved by the CIA. Fast forward a few years, and Ben Ali, and especially his second wife and her extended family, had become widely despised for their nepotism and greed, which was in contrast to the time of Bourguiba's rule. In recent years, IMF measures had reduced tax rates on business, but increased VAT, which obviously hit the poorest worse. Post-2008, new graduates reached 40,000 a year in a population of 10 million. The official unemployment rate was 14%, but three times that for graduates. Huge. Then followed some WikiLeaks cables detailing widespread corruption among Ben Ali's extended family. It was in this context that Bouazizi, a graduate with no job, responsible for providing for a family of four, having borrowed money to buy vegetables to sell, humiliated by police harassment, and expected to pay a bribe to get a permit, made his final statement and set himself alight. A month later, Ben Ali was gone. What this means for Tunisians, I'll get to a bit later, but within days, demonstrations erupted in Egypt with placards protesting against corruption and high unemployment. Same as in Tunisia. And calling for a legitimate democracy and improved living standards. Chants of bread, freedom, dignity, social justice, and Mubarak, go out. Chants like these and placards with these and similar messages sprang up in cities all around Egypt and the greater Arab world in quick succession. And they were pounced on by media and shown around the world. Excitement grew. Was this the start of democracy in a part of the world that's long been criticised for repression by regimes and general quietude for the citizenry? The Arab League, too, had long been criticised by the West for failing to act together on behalf of their citizens, to make any effective long-term agreements regarding their stance towards Israel, especially related to occupied Palestine. Egypt and Jordan both had long-standing individual peace treaties with Israel against popular opinion and putting them at odds with the wider Arab world. Could this be the time that at last the will of the people would win out and democracy would triumph over entrenched dictatorships? While getting a daily dose of the news from big media, whether television or internet, was no problem, what was a problem was what to believe. You could tune into any of the major programmes, CNN, BBC, Al Jazeera, Press TV, Russia Today, France 24, all manner of stations. There was much credibility given in certain quarters to social media coming from the countries enmeshed in upheaval and cracked down by security forces. And there can be little doubt that social media played a big part in organising and rallying the protesters. But as scenarios unfolded, it became clearer that often all was not what it seemed. As the media is wont to do, certain selected shots would be played over and over again, having the accepted, possibly unverifiable version home, it was almost impossible to question its validity. Then there were the obvious follow our government's line examples, as happened with Al Jazeera English. In 2008-09, they had given remarkable coverage in Gaza when Israel had attacked relentlessly and almost no other media was there. But in 2011, when protesters gathered at Pearl Roundabout in Bahrain, they were there at the beginning, but as soon as the Gulf Cooperation Council became involved and the regime, backed up by the Saudi Arabian troops, came down extremely heavy-handedly, tear gassing, beating, arresting, even killing significant numbers, nothing was to be seen on their channel. However, they were gung-ho when it came to coverage of Libya and Syria, two nations with an agenda different from that of the Gulf states, and in particular the Gulf Cooperation Council, headed by Saudi Arabia. That was one blatant case of censorship by the Qatari regime, the leader of which owns the channel. Another well-known channel, which chooses to toe the government line and stand strongly behind both the US and Israel, is our own once-respected BBC. When Al Jazeera first started its English-language channel a handful of years ago, a number of well-known journalists from the BBC, unhappy with the rigidity of its policy and censorship from above, transferred to Al Jazeera, some to jump ship again recently. I think the moral of this particular tale is to regard the media in question is to question everything and demand evidence at all times. You could say that while the Gulf Cooperation Council, i.e. Saudi Arabia, pulls the Arab strings, the US pulls the international community's strings. UK governments and others are happy to toe the master's line. Neither Saudi Arabia nor the US wanted the world to hear about happenings in Bahrain, a state with a Sunni leader of a restless Shia majority population and home of the US's Fifth Fleet. A greater awareness of the facts in the minds of the great unwashed could only bring more claims of hypocrisy and double standards down on Western governments. I'd like to mention here the terms of the terms US, United States or America, which have slipped into common usage, so I feel compelled to use them. The USA is passé. I prefer to refer to it, then, as the DSPNA, the Disunited States of Part of North America, which I believe is more accurate. Anyway, back to the media. Most of the coverage was, still is, thin and definitely biased in support of democracy when it became clear that the friendly dictator was going down, and in support of regime change by rebels when an opportunity arose to unseat a non-compliant dictator. For instance, Mubarak in Egypt had long been supported by the US and UK. He'd stuck to the peace treaty with Israel. He kept Gazans penned in against popular public opinion. and he was rewarded with $3 billion of aid annually from the US, most of it to the military in the form of training and munitions, and much of the money finding its way back to where it originated from. There's little, if any, finding its way to the general population. Caught initially on the hop, Western governments hummed and hawed until that it's time for Mubarak to step down moment arrived, and the media then called repeatedly for democracy. Contrast this with Libya and Gaddafi. He being the West dictator we loved to hate from the beginning, for 40 plus years, he was a nationalist whose country, remember, a country created by the West, was sitting on huge deposits of must-have oil. Post-1969, the Gaddafi-Libyan revolution, the US and UK were thrown out of their military bases, and the transnational corporations, of which there were nearly 60 at that time, had severe limitations placed on them. The oil industry was nationalised, and Gaddafi's Libya soon developed to gain the highest human index level in Africa by far. He was a huge threat to the West, because he was attempting to build a pan-African alliance and a financial system based on the gold dinar as a counterweight to the American dollar. The West alternately hated him and courted him as it suited their own interests. Remember the heavy sanction placed on Libya after the Lockerbie plane bombing incident, with a sham trial and a sham inquiry years later, when plenty of evidence pointed to Mubarak's innocence and guilty parties elsewhere. Remember Blair and Sarkozy, etc., cozying up to Gaddafi in his tent after more than $1 billion in compensation had been paid by Libya, therefore that he was contrite and could once again be accepted into the bosom of the international community. That is, until the golden opportunity presented itself in the form of the Arab Spring. With two dictators unseated, Ben Ali and Mubarak, and another, Saleh in Yemen, struggling, what better plan could there be than to foment unrest from inside the country using special forces and to support and arm small rebel groups from outside to hasten the required domino effect? In the early days of the protests, as demonstrators were met with crackdowns, violence, tear gas, arrests and tanks, the numbers attending protests grew very quickly, and a similar pattern appeared in each new country. Friday being the traditional day for mass attendance at lunchtime prayers, this was always the day for extra numbers and maybe some surprises at the demonstrations following prayers. Whilst the early months of 2011 saw the fall of three of the West allies in the region, the protests following and inspired by these in Yemen, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia and Jordan, they'd be seen by Western powers as beneficial to Iran, Syria, Hezbollah and Hamas, quite unacceptable. So the machine had to go into action, the Western, US and Israeli coalition, to counter popular resistance and to bolster the client states. Whereas the protesters in Egypt, Tunisia and Bahrain had been peaceful, in Libya it was a different matter. There, the insurgency was largely armed and organised by outside forces, even to the extent of special forces and foreign intelligence agents' intervention from France, UK, Qatar, US, Israel. They would spark events, and then when the legitimate government responded with force, they could be accused of human rights violations against their own citizens, and the UN would kindly vote to use responsibility to protect, and in so doing, instigating a no-fly zone killing, beginning a killing rampage of their own. In this instance, I simply present Gaddafi's Libya as one of the different examples that Western powers could not allow to continue on its independent path, for two main reasons. It restricted access to the West neoliberal businesses, and it would show too many of their own flaws and hypocrisies. The self-righteous claims of the US, the UK, and other NATO allies that they were intervening to protect lives flies in the face of evidence that foreign intervention in both Libya and Syria had been planned some time before the Arab Spring broke forth. As regards Syria, which allies itself with Russia and previously the Soviet Union, reason enough to attract hostility from the West, there were plans back in 1957 between Macmillan and Eisenhower to use the CIA and MI6 to create skirmishes, border clashes, and acts of sabotage in order to enable an international intervention to bring down the nationalist regime. The USSR warned against intervention then, as Russia is doing now. Whilst Russia and China are both trading partners and have military cooperation with Syria, Syria is viewed by the West as the route to Iran, which also must be tamed. Wesley Clark, previous Supreme Allied Commander Europe, in discussion with a military advisor at the Pentagon in November 2001, when he asked about plans to go into Iraq, was told that that was part of a five-year campaign involving seven countries. Remember this? The original axis of evil? Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Iran, Somalia, and Sudan. Since I've been away, no. Sudan, June the 16th, by the way, student protests against austerity were put down very heavily. I don't know if you heard about that. Think about that. Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Iran, Somalia, and Sudan. Six of these are currently in turmoil as a result of Western interference. Only Iran is left. Rogue states, which, as far as Western powers are concerned, support or supported terrorism and must therefore be brought to heel or be persuaded to be more compliant to the wishes of the current masters of the world. In today's scenario in Syria, NATO partners include Israel, Egypt, the Gulf states, and Saudi Arabia. There's long been a strong military alliance between Israel and Turkey, and both of these are supporting the armed insurgency. Mossad and Salafist terrorists are working together in southern Syria. Turkish special forces and Muslim Brotherhood groups are working together in the north. The refugee camps protected by Turkish military in Turkey's Hatay province, which are for the most part off-limits to the media, are being used as training camps for armed insurgents who come and go over the border. There are Sunni radicals from Iraq, groups of foreign fighters which were earlier in Libya, and some of Al-Qaeda fighters have been captured in possession of Turkish weapons. Syrian exile groups in France and the US are getting support and finance coming from Saudi Arabia. It's an incredibly tangled web. Alistair Crook, a former MI6 official, high-level EU advisor, he commented in March sometime this year, I thought which was interesting, about what he called the travesty of those calling to follow the Libyan model, i.e., quote, outside groups backed by outside powers armed by outsiders to overthrow a regime illegitimately in favour of a regime friendly to those outside powers. Interference in both Libya and Syria from NATO powers, including proxy Israel, has been well documented. Interference by special forces stirring up dissent, training groups of foreign fighters, Al-Qaeda and the like. The US and the UK have long been partial to working with such groups. For an in-depth look, especially at UK involvement over the years, I recommend Mark Curtis's book, Secret Affairs, Britain's Collusion with Radical Islam. Tells you a lot. There has been speculation as to the motives of Western intervention. Splitting the region up into smaller, more manageable, controllable parts, i.e. balkanisation, is one possibility. It happened a century ago when the area was redrawn post-Ottoman Empire, when the architects maybe didn't get it quite right. At that time, arbitrary lines were drawn on maps enclosing rival tribes or factions in one country. For instance, Iraq, with its discrete Sunni, Shia and Kurdish areas, and think about the sectarian problems that we have there now, or Libya's three former separate provinces, which they may well become again through bloody factional intertribal fighting. In 1982, Oded Yinon, a senior advisor to Israel's foreign ministry, drew up a plan to break up the Middle Eastern Arab countries, especially Egypt, Lebanon, Syria and Iraq, along ethnic and sectarian lines, in order to create smaller states, making them weaker, more unstable and easier to manipulate. That was called the Yinon plan. Now, it's a plan which is acceptable to the neocons in Washington, who have a strong pro-Zionist bias, and a similar document encompassing a much wider area, this one, was drawn up by part of the US military more recently This was Colonel Ralph Peters, called the Project for the New Middle East. The US definitely sees itself as the world's policeman, or controller, and looking at polls in countries negatively affected by their actions, military or otherwise, they are actually perceived as the world's greatest threat. In this area of the world, very, very high numbers have been polled, as which is the world's greatest threat. The US gets 80% plus in many of these countries. Everything has to be done their way, or else they allow themselves to make laws to suit their own agenda. The president signs executive orders at will and against the US's own laws. The US-Israel incestuous Zionist relationship has shaped much of the interference that we've witnessed throughout the region at this time. The UN's bias, too, is always towards Western hegemony by using pressure, or carrot and stick, on the small states to comply with the international community. The UN Security Council is totally unbalanced for a fair world order, being the same as the International Criminal Court is unbalanced. For instance, it's okay to prosecute and fine guilty such as Charles Taylor for crimes in Sierra Leone, or Milosevic, Karadzic and Mladic in the Balkans, but not heads of state, presidents or prime ministers of important Western countries who clearly committed war crimes. Recently, there was held a war crimes tribunal in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, which found George Bush guilty for his adventures in Iraq and Afghanistan. But does anyone expect these findings to be taken seriously anywhere that matters? So, let's see if I can give some perspective as to why the response from the West varies so much from regime to regime. Basically, from the Western point of view, we have two discrete groups. Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, Jordan, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf states on the one hand, and Libya, Syria, Iraq, Iran on the other. The first are all allies or clients of the Western bloc, US and NATO countries, which will continue to support or prop up regimes which remain compliant. And they will remain compliant to a large extent to protect their own interests, not those of the population as a whole. Those in the other group have all proved unwilling over the decades to fit into the West plans for them and remain fixed on their own nationalist agendas. So as a result, they must be prepared to suffer the bloody consequences of assault, invasion, enforced regime change. Also, I think we need to bear in mind that the region, largely Muslim, is mostly Sunni for various factions. Wahhabi and Salafi being the most extreme interpretations of the Quran, and Saudi Arabia being dominant because of oil wealth. On the other side is Iran, non-Arab, and Shia, together with Syria, which has a majority Sunni population, but a minority Shia Alawite regime. And Iraq, which, if the Kurds, who are Sunni, decide to permanently distance themselves from Baghdad, which is looking likely, will have a majority Shia population. Hence, the Saudi-Iranian tensions, which join Syria and Lebanon too, in a big way, because of the strong Hezbollah movement there. So, a brief look at the current situation in a handful of the Arab Spring countries. Tunisia. At the end of October last year, in Sidi Bouzid, the town where Bouzid set light to himself, violence erupted again, as youth marched through the centre, smashing windows and burning tyres in reaction to the cancellation of seats won by the Populist Party because of supposed financial irregularities. Secularists are losing ground to religious conservatives, and extremely self-styled, self-appointed morality groups are closing down brothels, harassing outlets serving alcohol, and generally policing neighbourhoods to enforce their own agenda. But the neoliberal system is still firmly in place. Most recently, all demonstrations have been banned. However, regarding the post-regime change elections, I found this interesting. Turnout was 80% of the 50% who had registered to vote. So 40% of the electorate voted. The Ennahda Party, the Awakening Party, the main Islamist party, won 41% of vote casts. That works about 16% of the total electorate. Okay? So winning, despite the fact that over 80% didn't vote for them. Now let's compare this with the UK. May 2010, when turnout was 65%, Conservatives got 36% of the total vote, which works out at just over 20% of the eligible voters, meaning almost 80% of the electorate didn't vote for them either. So I guess Tunisia is about as well represented as you are here. Libya. Again. Wow. It's their election this weekend, isn't it? Libya. Note the double standards re the prosecution of war crimes. The call for Saif al-Islam to be tried by the International Criminal Court, but no recognition of Western war crimes. I've already said this, I know, but let me say it again. Bush, Blair, Obama, Cameron's alliance, and in this instance, NATO leaders, as there rarely, if ever, has been throughout the decades of intervention, regime change, and coup d'etat on behalf of puppet dictators all around the world. When are we going to look at getting them? In January this year, with the National Transition Council running things, Doctors Without Borders withdrew from detention centres in Misrata, citing as the reason that they were being expected to fix up allegedly pro-Gaddafi torture victims so they could be tortured some more by opponents of Gaddafi's regime. Atrocities very similar to those in the spring of 2011 when 50 blacks, supposed to be foreign mercenaries fighting for Gaddafi, but actually black Libyans, were rounded up into a building and fired, supported by the National Transitional Council. And now, incidents daily show a horror story of recriminatory acts of violence, like the reports of chemical weapons being used recently against a Western Libyan pro-Gaddafi tribe. From a reasonably stable country to one involved in a spiralling civil war as tribes and factions jockey for power and influence, in danger of breaking into three separate areas while the West happily courts the leaders in order to sign, seal and deliver trade deals advantageous to their own national and transnational corporate companies. Back in business, great. Bahrain. This small island connected to mainland Saudi Arabia by a causeway. By the way, that causeway was built, I forget, 30 or something years ago by Saudi Arabia. They have a 70% majority Shia population, which is disproportionately affected by unemployment, poverty, land ownership, and political exclusion. Bahrain has been of strategic interest to outside powers for centuries because of its geographical position. Britain had heavy involvement through and following two world wars, and now it's the era of US dominance with the Fifth Fleet stationed there. Just across the Persian Gulf lies Iran, which pre-revolution in 1979 had considerable interests and many emigrants living in Bahrain, until the emir, a Sunni, decided that his better option lay with the Arab Gulf states. For Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Cooperation Council, Sunni Wahhabis, a democratic Bahrain would be a nightmare, close to its own eastern minority Shia population based around the oil-producing region. Last November, in a report commissioned by the King of Bahrain, it was found that unnecessary and excessive force was used by the government security forces. At that time, 35 were killed, thousands arrested, many tortured, but there's been no change in policy. The killing and the torture goes on. The US and its NATO allies have been like the three monkeys, blind, deaf and dumb to the horrendous events as they progress, and especially to calls for democracy and human rights. No plans for R2P there. The ex-Deputy Metropolitan Police Chief, John Yates, a phone hacking infamy. He's been overseeing security in Bahrain for the last few months. Not the first Brit to hold such a post there. Colonel Sir Ian Henderson was the main architect and overseer of the detention and torture programme between 1968 and 98, with a reputation as a thoroughly objectionable beast of a human being, to put it kindly. Mid-May saw the move for Saudi Arabia to merge with Bahrain. It took over, in fact, with no input apart from more protests by the populace. It was effectively a takeover and very convenient for the US and its thousands of personnel stationed there on account of the Fifth Fleet. It was around this time that the heads of the nurses and teachers' trade unions were jailed for 15 years for supporting democracy protests, and 3,000 workers were dismissed for participating in them. But as the arrests, detentions and torture go on, so too do the protests. Very recently, one imprisoned doctor there has gone on hunger strike to try and draw attention to the serious state of affairs. Yemen. The old regime is still incumbent, with Saleh still in the background. A third of children are malnourished. There's horrendous poverty and starvation, but the protests are ongoing, and there's a widening gulf between north and south, with frequent skirmishes and US drones regularly targeting al-Qaeda terrorists, which is sure to win hearts and minds, just as it did in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Egypt. In February this year, just days after 73 were killed in a soccer brawl, 3 days of street battles followed with a siege of the Interior Ministry. Protesters continue to rally against the military-led government. Battles which have been ongoing since October and which have led to burnt-out buildings, rubble-strewn streets, tear gas hanging in the air, and a maze of concrete barriers giving a picture of a war zone, which is sort of what it is. There was a new freely elected government with a majority of seats going to Islamist parties. But suddenly, Parliament was dissolved by the Constitutional Court immediately before the second round of elections for president. The government was already in limbo because a new constitution was to be written after the presidential elections, but the incumbent constitution was the previous military one. I do have details of election results if anybody's interested. On March the 20th, the government voted to declare Israel the number one enemy. This is interesting too. They voted to declare Israel the number one enemy, to withdraw their ambassador from Tel Aviv, to cut off oil and gas supplies, and to withdraw from the 1979 peace agreement recognising Israel. Now, depending on what follows immediately, now we've had all the upheaval of the second presidential election, and then he being told what he should say, and the military saying that they're still in control, it sort of changes things a little bit. What did the new president say? I'll tell you in a minute. In June, there were more demos and riots against the status quo becoming entrenched. Anger at the weak response and dissenting of Mubarak and the acquittal of many others. Do you know that when Mubarak actually reaches 84, which is next year, he has total immunity by law anyway? 20 minutes after polling station closed in the second round of the presidential elections, SCARF, that's the military council, issued a constitutional decree, in effect a coup, taking over full control of political life, including all budgetary and legislative powers, until a new parliament is elected. They also can decide the composition of the Constituent Assembly and control the drafting of the new constitution. So the military is still in firm control there, any future government, including the president. 24th of June, Morsi, the Islamist candidate, was declared the winner in his acceptance speech when he pledged to honour Egypt's international treaties, which is rather a 180-degree turn from what they'd said and what they'd agreed in Parliament. So we have to watch the space, don't we, as far as that goes. Syria. In late February this year, a video was released with al-Zawahiri calling on neighbouring Muslims to join the uprising against Assad's government. This is Wahhabi Sunni against Alawite Shia. With subsequent reductions in problems in Iraq's Sunni provinces, especially in Nineveh, as its core was heeded and a mass exodus ensued from there and moved over to Syria. As for the opposition from outside Syria, the Syrian National Council is largely a Muslim Brotherhood group, allied with the House of Saud and Qatar. The Free Syrian Army is made up of defectors, Assad opponents, and foreign mercenaries, especially Salafist extremists, with weaponry supplied by the Gulf Cooperation Council. I heard yesterday that Switzerland has cancelled all arms sales with Israel, because weapons have been sent to them or being found among the terrorists in Syria. Don't know what will happen there either, or if it makes any difference. At the time of the 1991 Gulf War, when Assad's father was in power in Syria, when he was in power, Syria participated with the West against Saddam Hussein, because in this instance Syria was an ally. It was absolutely fine to turn a blind eye to another terribly repressive round of domestic repression in Syria, when Assad's father killed all kinds of people who were against him at that time. But that was okay, because then the West were able to, Syria consolidated their power in Lebanon, and the West just blinked and turned the other way. Now, with the Western alliance hell-bent on applying the Libyan model, and Russia and China and other less powerful nations too, dead against intervention, this has been a dreadful debacle, costing lives on all sides and causing ruin and chaos in an earlier stable country. Having spilled over into Lebanon now and threatening to cause internal problems in Turkey, increased instability in the region, a previously stated aim, seems to be coming to fruition. 19th of June, the president of the US-backed Kurdistan National Assembly of Syria calls on Israel to support the breakup of Syria in an ethnic-based federal structure. That was in the Jerusalem Post, i.e. to balkanize it by fostering sectarian divisions, a la Yugoslavia. New York Times and Washington Post both confirm reports that the US is sending in arms of various kinds, smuggling across the Turkish border, both CIA and State Department involvement. Associated Press reports Tunisian radical jihadists flocking to Syria. The Swiss cancelled arms supplies to Qatar and Saudi Arabia is what that was, not Israel. Excuse me, I forgot that one. I remember that incorrectly. So the Arab Spring, what, if anything, can we learn? What, if anything, is the potential? Whose are the gains? Whose are the losses? Just how compatible are the different cultures, developments on the ground, and the wider religious impulse to socialism? Certainly, viewing the events of the last 18 months through a socialist lens, away from Western norms and measuring sticks, first we need to dismiss any illusions of where these protests were headed from the start, never mind where they're going now. The bulk of the protesters in these countries, where the demonstrations were genuinely started by the grassroots as opposed to outside interference, were not deeply politically engaged or aware. They were aroused by dire economic circumstances, for which they blamed their corrupt regimes, Israel, and the West. History shows that the so-called Western democracies have themselves taken centuries to emerge from religion, wars, ethnic cleansing, and various attempts at revolution. The accumulated wealth and power of Western nations have come from centuries of exploitation of poorer areas. Now, these same Western countries, democracies, were heading for the same dire economic circumstances and brutal police crackdown on protesters opposed to how their democratic nations were being run, as this was being experienced in the Arab world. What sparked the Western world's protest is not dissimilar to the causes of the Arab Spring. While socialists tend to trace all the outcomes to their symptoms back to the root cause, capitalism, and explain over and again with the aim of raising awareness for the need to rid ourselves of the disease once and for all, our call falls on many deaf ears because too many are hardwired into the idea of piecemeal reform and can't seem to see their way past the going nowhere cul-de-sac trap. Many Western observers saw the fall of Ben Ali and Mubarak as the possible catalyst for a domino effect and a move towards liberal democracy in the region. Against this was seen the risk of reactionary Islamist alternative taking hold, which, once entrenched, would be impossible to remove. Examples being given were Iran and Saudi Arabia. The US and its European allies would be quite comfortable dealing with an alliance of military rulers and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, for example, an alliance which would be supported by Saudi Arabia, possibly Israel, depending on how recent developments turn out regarding the peace plan, gas deals, and so on. As long as they play by the West rules, it's okay, but an independent-minded regime determined to follow its own plan, like Iran, would be seen as unfriendly. Political pragmatism seems to mean working with regimes that are willing to compromise their ideology, as when the US backed various nasty regimes in South Vietnam, but ultimately lost. When the US and UK backed the Shah of Iran and lost to the revolution Ayatollah Khomeini. When in the 80s they armed Osama bin Laden, who ultimately turned on them. And meanwhile, for decades, they backed Mubarak, and now spectators to a possible replay of the Iranianism as takeover of a possible uprising. Or maybe not. Now the military is taking steps to entrench themselves and their man Shafiq. Well, that's out of date now. Shafiq is not entrenched. But he's still there. All this pragmatism is simply proof of the duplicity of governments in what they say their intentions and policies are and what they actually are in reality. It's all about interests. Washington's interests, and by default UK's interests too, are those of both Israel, i.e. ideological, and of Saudi Arabia, i.e. oil, and so they gladly embrace the Wahhabi nexus and eagerly pursue the Zionist aims. It's a curious political axis, US, Israel, Saudi Arabia, to keep Iran reined in. What's the future of the Arab Spring? We could recognise it as an ongoing struggle for democracy and self-determination. However, so far, there are scant signs of any changes to benefit the vast majority. Just increased entrenchment of parts of the old regimes, existing religious blocs, and the military. The way I see it is pretty much the same as for the rest of us. A steady tightening of laws and increased controls of the general population, more horrors committed against citizens, anything to keep the populace down, anything to cause anxiety and fear, including all kinds of oppression, restricted internet, enhanced security laws, personal details mandatory available across all authorities, indiscriminate stop and search or arrests and disappearances, heightened security controls anywhere and everywhere, airports, shopping centres, sports halls and schools, gated communities in public spaces, and more prisons and detention facilities will spring up. Robocops will feature as part of our everyday experience. Drones will be used for spying and general control. There'll be harsher conditions in general and camps for the re-education of dissidents. Think Huxley and Orwell, and don't be surprised. I mean, it's already happening, isn't it? And it's not remotely funny. But the reality is being recognised more widely around the world, and that has to be good. And globally, we are able to connect and communicate with others more simply, quickly, and widely than ever before, and that too is good. No one needs to use fancy words or phrases to explain their position regarding their work and life situation, whether in the Maghreb, the Middle East, Europe, North America, or anywhere else for that matter. People know they are not getting what they crave, a life of reasonable comfort and security, working at a satisfying chosen calling, raising a family with access to good health care and education, living a life of self-determined choices. In short, individual human potential fulfilled to the satisfaction of each and every individual. And they're not going to get any of that from these protests, however heroic they may be. Collectively, though, individuals in enough numbers, vast numbers, could capture ideologically the tools of suppression of governments and military dictatorships and thus bring about the kind of societies they foresee. Part of getting there is a recognition that members of the armed forces, police and paramilitaries around the world are the same species as the rest of us, and somehow they need to be awakened to the reality that they are on the same side as the rest of us. In their present role, they're simply working as tools for their paymasters against the interests of their fellow citizen workers. Increased awareness on a global scale is the must for any improvement in the human condition. It's the only way to move forward to socialism, to be able to combat status quo politically and totally democratically. What is required is increased awareness and understanding that it is the structure of the global capitalist system which is at the root of all the calls for change. A structure organised to benefit a few at a huge cost to the many. What's happening around the world now is vindication for us that is the only way forward.